This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
A very good afternoon to you all. You having a good destination show? Have you found your holiday yet? Nobody found the holiday yet? Are you alive? Are you well? Are you just taking a seat after lunch? How many here, let's get a bit of audience participation, how many of you here own a dog or have petted a dog? Once saw a dog, wish they had a dog, know what a dog looks like. Right. Daryl does an extraordinary thing. As you've heard from Roddy, who introduced this show, he used to work for the Royal Army Veterinary Corps, REVC. He knows his dogs. He's been a dog trainer, a dog handler. He has retasked into an area that is absolutely vital. For those of you that haven't been to one of these events at the Stamfords Travel Writing Festival, embedded in the Destination Exhibition, we have a partner charity this year, which is Explorers Against Extinction. And in association with Explorers Against Extinction, Daryl's charity, Animals Saving Animals, does some fascinating and rather important work in the field of anti-poaching. So before we start talking about what Daryl does, I'm going to get him to explain, through questions I'm asking him, I will ask him, about how severe the threat of poaching is against the sort of keynote defining species that we know are in danger, whether it's elephants or rhinos or whatever. So Daryl, one, a very warm welcome.
Thank you.
You don't look dressed for the English winter. Where have you just come back from?
I've actually just come back from 3 weeks in Mozambique. We were training combat tracker dogs in the rainforest out there in the Nyasa National Park. Nyasa National Park is about 6,000 square kilometres, and it's the biggest...
Big space.
Yeah, it's the biggest national park in Mozambique. And what they're finding in now is because the elephants are now moving into this area because they realise it's a safe space to actually inhabit.
Yep.
They're not going to be poached. So obviously with that is drawing in the poaching fraternity, and we're now having to move in and secure the area.
It's sort of an impossible question for you to answer, but can you give us just a sort of thumbnail sketch of how serious the poaching threat is, not only to these animals, to the elephants specifically, but also to the communities that have to live alongside these animals, how they interrelate?
The best way to put it across is probably figures. So we're losing about 100 elephant a day now on average. We're losing 3 rhino a day on average, 1 ranger a day across Africa.
Slow that down. Did we get that? We are losing 100 elephants a day. You got that?
What we're finding with the elephant especially is people think that the elephants are targeted. So they look for a tusker, they target that tusker. It doesn't work like that. Obviously, these elephants are in communities, in herds, and they generally, if they're going to go into a herd, they will take down the entire herd.
Mothers, calves,
everything,
young bulls,
absolutely
adult
everything.
Males, heads of the tribes.
There's various ways they're doing it now. It can range from crossbow, which is a silent way of taking the elephants down, to poisoning water holes, to literally just going in there with assault rifles.
And so it's not just guys with AK-47s firing, spraying bullets. They're evolved, they're changing, they're adapting their attack mechanisms in order to evade the very thing that you're trying to prevent.
Yeah, make no mistake, this isn't for what a lot of people think, the local villagers just making a living. This is now organised crime on a professional level. So within any poaching team, you'll have a sniper who will be armed with either a 4.58 or 3.75. You'll have a tracker who is a professionally trained ex-army tracker, and you'll generally have 2 ex-soldiers who will be gunmen, and their sole role is to protect the 2 other men within the unit. This also goes down now to values as well. When I first moved into the anti-poaching field about 6 years ago, rhino horn, for instance, was about $35,000 a kilo. Now we're talking about $200,000 a kilo.
Good Lord.
So you're talking 3 times the value of gold.
So the average poacher attack on a small herd of elephant, as you say, will be worth to them how much?
For a 15 kilo sort of tusks off a bull elephant, you'd be talking about, for them, it would be about $3,000 in total, which isn't a great amount. So obviously rhino horn is where they're heading,
sure,
unless they can get many. But by the time it actually hits the markets, you're talking about a markup of about $320,000.
Sweet mercy. So it's big money, it attracts the
It's organised crime. It is organised crime.
International organised crime. I say international, who are these poachers? Are these people living in country, in territory, or are these people from off, as we would say in Norfolk, coming in and
There's generally a mix. Again, people think it's local communities, it's not. If you're talking about a professional poaching gang, if they lose a member of their gang, for instance, they may well take 6 months to recruit another member of the gang, and he will be professionally sourced. It won't be just recruiting a local. The only time you tend to find there will be a local within an area is just for the initial intelligence, feeding them of where these animals are within the conservancies or parks.
Right.
Because they need to know where these animals are positioned.
Okay. Well, let's have a little bit of biography about you, and then we're going to cut some VT. So this is the threat. It's persistent. It's increasing. It's increasingly profitable. It's attracting more people. We have a decreasing population of elephant and rhino, both black and white.
Yeah, definitely.
You have experience in dogs. When did the magic moment come when you thought, hold on, I know dogs, I can see a part of a solution to this bigger problem? How did that come about?
About 6 years ago, I was asked to go out to Old Bujetta in Kenya, and they said to do some continuation training with their present dog section.
What does continuation training mean?
It basically means they have a dog section as such, but they need some professional training in regards to how to deploy the dogs.
Right.
When I got out there, I was somewhat surprised. I was expecting a professionally run dog section. It was effectively a shed in the bush. That's the only way to describe it. The dogs, because they had no experience of dogs, they'd obviously purchased these dogs. It was a good idea. They could see the potential, but they didn't know how to deploy them. The other main point about me going out there was they were using one dog for one role. So they would have a bloodhound for tracking, and then they would have a German Shepherd or a Malinois for purely an assault basis, apprehension basis. What I did was said, hang on a minute, this is effectively a crime scene. Why don't we take on the British police dog, which is a triple role dog, and adapt that to an anti-poaching role, which is what we did, which is why we're now having the successes.
Okay, a couple of statistics. So the charity Animal Saving Animals has been going for 6 years?
Yeah, approximately, yeah.
And you mentioned the word Malinois or Malinois dogs. Why did you choose this breed? What makes them so special?
A Belgian Malinois is it's a subbreed of the Belgian Shepherd, and effectively it's the infantry soldier of attack dogs. It was designed and bred.
Look at that. They look so cute. How can that possibly be an infantry soldier of attack dogs?
Believe it, out of that litter there, we chose three of the dogs, and all three of those dogs are now operational. When we talk about being the infantry soldier of attack dogs, I really cannot underestimate this fact. At 12 weeks, these dogs are like little velociraptors. They really are. All they want to do, you literally hold them, and they just... And that's all they want to do is bite. To give you a very quick story, I was out in Kenya, and we took on 11 of these dogs, and we trained them out in Kenya, and I had the whole litter of 11 dogs in this compound. Now, being an experienced trainer, I should have known better than to do this, but for some reason, the puppy breeder in me, the little boy in me, took over, and I went, I know, let's put all of these dogs in the compound together and let them all run around and make friends and play together. That was my first mistake. The second mistake I made was realizing the lock on the door was on the outside, not on the inside, so when I was in there, I couldn't get out. I let these dogs out. They're all running around having play. I'm playing with a tug toy. All of a sudden, one of these dogs at 13 weeks bites me on the leg. And they're like little needles going into your leg. And you think, oh! And you sort of take this dog off your leg. And all of a sudden, there was another one on the other leg. And before I knew it, because it's this great game to these puppies, and they've been used tug toys, I literally had 11 dogs biting me. When I'm saying that I was running for my life out of that compound, I had one on my bum, my trousers were ripped, and all the handlers I was training were on the other side of the fence just looking on. You know, I was thinking this was great fun, and I'm hanging on the gate trying to get out, and they're still biting me. So when we talk about the effectiveness of these dogs, they were absolutely born for the job. They've got about a biting strength of about 140 to 200 pounds per square inch. So that's the equivalent of putting your hand in a hydraulic clamp and just letting
Good
it
Lord.
Shut. I was bitten by accident by one of my dogs, actually, about 3 years ago. I was doing a training exercise with him where we were putting the dog through a car vehicle window, teaching him to jump through car vehicle windows. Unbeknown to me, there was an attack suit inside the vehicle. The dog smelt the attack suit, and as we put him through the vehicle, he just came back and chewed me on the hand. It was a bit mixed emotions, really, because obviously I wanted him to get off my hand, but I was also pleased that my training was successful, and he hung on and just kept chewing on my hand. So, but he actually broke my hand in two places and put 40 stitches in my hand. So you'll hear a lot of stories about how you should do this when a dog attacks you, you should do that. You honestly, you don't do anything. You really don't. You just roll around in pain. You really do.
Okay, so you talked a bit about... Talk us a little bit about how you select the puppies that you need for this task, and then we'll see some VT.
What we do is we'll look at, we'll have a litter offered to us, and we'll normally select maybe one or two dogs from that litter. Believe it or not, puppy selection has a huge amount to do when you're actually even selecting a dog for yourself at home. People tend to go for one of two types of dog. They go for the one that runs up towards you. Don't touch it. Don't touch it, because that's the dog that's going to be chewing logs in your fireplace, gnawing on your table. It'll be a handful from the day it's born. It's confident. Then you have the other type of dog that you think is sitting in the back of the bed, and you think, he's a little timid one. He's the one you don't want to touch either, because he's going to have the anxiety problems. He's not as brave. What we want is the dog that we call approachable but suspicious, you know. So what he'll do is he'll look at a situation, he'll look at you, work you out, and then come up to you. And that's the dog you want, because he's a thinking dog. We do several tests with the dogs when we're selecting them. One is a ball with a string, so we have a rubber ball with a piece of string and we just swing it. And obviously the dog that just backs off, we don't pick. The one that just runs in and effectively just gets hit with the tennis ball, we don't pick. What we want is the one that judges it and then goes in for the attack. We also do other tests with food, for instance. So at sort of 12, 13 weeks, the dogs recognise their bag of kibble, their dog food. So we have like a drum, and we get a bowl, and we fill the bowl with kibble, and then we get the paper bag, empty paper bag, and we throw it on the floor. You'll guarantee you'll have 9 or 10 of those puppies will start scrapping around on the paper because they can smell it, but there'll always be one puppy that just sort of sits there underneath the bowl and has realised the food's in the bowl, and that's the dog you want. You want the thinking dog. So it really does have a lot to do with it.
Can we roll VT1, please, now? Hello, can we have VT1, please? Fantastic. Right, that's an indication of how you train and what you're training them for. So what are you training them to do? Why are they so vital? What can dogs do that makes them so effective as an anti-poaching measure?
As I said, all our dogs are based on the British police dog.
Yep.
So they're all trained to do one of three things. They're all trained to apprehend, they're trained to search for arms and ammunition or associated items, and they're also taught to track. When we say track, they can track up to about 48 hours cold, all areas, urban and rural, populated areas, even crossing rivers. This is where I've been for the last 3 weeks, putting advanced tracker training into these dogs. The key thing about these dogs is that they have a skill that humans don't have. By trade, I'm a combat tracker. So I can not only handle a tracker dog in all environments, I can also read an environment and tell you where a human's been through spore and various other applications. What we can't do is track at night. Now, unfortunately, that's when poachers move. They either generally take an animal down at first light or last light. This is where the dogs come into their own, because they can track at night. So what we can do is we can track during the day, we can use the tracker dogs, but when the poachers actually go down to rest at night thinking they're safe, or they rest up before, for instance, a attempted kill, we can move in quietly on them. And the first they know about it is when we're actually over the top of them waiting. They're generally fast asleep thinking they're safe.
Okay. There's something that strikes me as being crucial to this. These are highly trained dogs, they're valuable, they have a financial value, but also, you know, they're part of a team. We know that we protect our anti-poaching men, our guards, the monitors, all that sort of stuff, with bulletproof vests, with helmets, that sort of stuff. How are the dogs protected themselves? Because, of course, the poachers will start soon, if not already, see these dogs as a threat and will start to target the dogs. How do you protect them?
You're right in what you're saying. Poaching, as poaching evolves, we have to evolve. So the poachers are actually realising that the tracker dogs are actually the tool that is taking us to an apprehension, to a capture. So you are right, dogs are being targeted. They're being targeted in various ways. What I can say is that during my time in Africa, we've never lost a dog in service.
Good.
How does this happen? Well, the first thing is they're all wearing ballistic armour. So the chances of actually, if they were to get pangered, for instance, it just goes across the armour. We've never actually had a dog injured or shot. But to give you an idea of why this doesn't happen, you really have to place yourself into a poaching situation. So you're talking about a dog that can move at 32 kilometres an hour, and it has a side profile. So obviously we have a wide profile when we're in approach. A dog is effectively on a side profile. Again, humans tend to move in a straight line. A dog doesn't. A dog is naturally lazy by character, so it moves around from left to right. When we actually release a dog, you only have maybe 6 seconds before you actually realise. And the only thing you actually know that's happening is that you feel this... Now, behind the dog is a follow-up team. Now, that follow-up team is an armed team. So as a poacher, it's dark. You can't see where the dog's come from. The dog's moving at 32 kilometres an hour, and he's moving underneath the grass line. So all you don't know where he's coming from. Now, he's going to hit you at £200 per square inch, and when he does hit you, you then know the follow-up team are coming. To give you an idea about how a dog bites, people think the dog just bites you on the hand or the arm and he grips. He doesn't. If you're running, for instance, a full sprint, the most you can do is 22 kilometres an hour. A dog does 32 kilometres an hour. So when that dog hits you, you're absorbing 10 kilometres an hour of braking. That dog is effectively losing your arm as a brake. As we run, we put our arms back. A dog, as I said, is naturally lazy, so he goes for the first target that he sees when he's running. So what he does is this, he'll leap, your arm comes up, the dog will jump. We always teach the dogs to jump because then he's hitting you at full velocity. Remember, he weighs about 35 kilos in weight. So you've got 35 kilos in weight hitting you at 32 kilometres an hour with a biting strength of £200 per square inch. What he'll do is he'll bite you there. Then centrifugal forces will send that dog around in the air on your arm. His bite will slide from there to your wrist bone where it locks off. And then he pulls you down onto the ground. So, do you want to risk that? No. Every dog, I personally haven't released a dog in nearly 4 years, 5 years. Because of the word of mouth of what dogs are doing, it's a much better option to surrender and actually go like this than it is to actually face the dog and the possible apprehension and the bites.
Fantastic. I think we've got a second piece of ET which shows somebody in a dog bite suit being pursued. Is that a good time to show that?
Yeah, it'd be good to, yeah, good.
Can we have VT2, please?
Welcome to Mukamasi Dog Section. What we're going to do now is a quick demonstration of the attack work that we do on a daily basis and the training exercises. The dog you're going to see is Freddy and the handler is Pernielli. They're going to do a patrol, a release and an apprehension.
Talk us over this if you want. What's this dog called?
This dog is called Freddy. He's with the handler Pernielli and they're in Mukamasi National Park in Tanzania. This dog is an exceptional dog because he always jumps high. Most dogs jump for the arm, he doesn't. He likes to jump for the neck and the shoulders. We've actually taught him to do that. Excuse the filming on the dog cam. But you see him jump now, he'll jump high.
Oh my word. They weigh what, 35 kilos, 70 odd pounds?
Yeah, Freddy's a big boy. He's about 33 kilos. He was actually responsible for a capture about 6 months ago from a local robbery. But we also, as well as working within the outposting world, we also help communities with local crime.
So there's good presence both within society and outside.
Yeah, definitely.
How long does it take to train them?
It takes about 8 months to a year. What we do is we train them for the first 7-8 months of their life. Then we send them out to their relevant unit, team them with their handler, and then we carry out the rest of the training operationally with the handler. Why do we do this? A fully trained Belgian Malinois is like a cocked gun, for want of a better expression. If we were to put them with a green handler, because you've got to bear in mind, most African handlers have never touched a dog before.
Yeah,
so to face him with a fully trained Belgian Malinois attack dog, it would be like putting an inexperienced rider on an experienced horse. The horse would just look around and go, happy days. You know, and we often laugh about this when we're putting the handlers through training, because we hand the dog over to the new handler and the dog's walking to heel nicely and his head's prancing along. We've only got one hand on the lead, and then we hand him to the handler and he just pulls them down the road and they're being pulled down the track. So what we do is we take them to a three-quarter stage. because they're not fully mature yet. So they're like a sponge, they're absorbing information, but they're not confident. So we take them to a new area in Africa. They're completely in a new environment, so they're looking for help. Someone's saying, look, give me guidance, give me help, the dog is. So we put them with the handler because the handler knows the environment and the, what's going on. And then the handler draws experience from the dog draws experience from the handler, and that way we don't get a potential accident out in the field.
Okay, fantastic. How much does it take, I mean, how much money? You're here as a charity, you don't have a book to sell. We're going to ask you to be generous as you leave this, because the money that you're able to put in the pots as you exit this theatre helps sustain the work that Daryl is doing and actually goes straight to the dogs. I don't. How many of you have been to the Destination show before in preceding years? Have any of you seen the conversation that Simon Reeve, the travel TV presenter, and I have spoken about in previous years? And Simon has a very strong moral argument for why we should travel in the way that we travel. And when you go to the game reserve, buy the little fridge magnet, do tip the guide that's taking you around, because the money that you put into that is the money that fuels the Land Rovers, that keeps the poachers out of the game reserve. It pays for the staff that keep the poachers out of the game reserve, all that sort of. This is your opportunity to do what Simon Reeve has spoken about here so many times, right here from Kensington Olympia, from the Destination show. Because the money that we're able to give Daryl today and Travellers Against Extinction, I've forgotten the name of the thing. Was it? Oh, no.
Explorers.
Explorers Against Extinction, forgive me. Travellers. Actually goes straight on the ground, which is why we've chosen these charities, goes straight to the ground. So it costs how much? So it's 8 months to train. How much does it cost to train a dog?
We do it on a not-for-profit rate. So basically the dog, what it costs to actually basic bonus train the dog is what we actually ask for in sponsorship.
Right.
The role of the actual charity is to fund a dog section is a tremendous amount of money for a conservancy. So what we do is we gather sponsors in, we gather money in, and we give the dog to them. It's about, for a two-dog dog section, it's about £17,000.
To train and deliver.
To actually deliver. If you were looking from a commercial company, £100,000.
Hundreds of thousands, no, exactly. I know that one of the reasons we picked you is that you are, one, cost-effective and truly on the ground effective. How much does it then therefore cost, once you've delivered, the people on the ground to sustain that dog, to feed it, to house it, to vet bills, all that sort of stuff?
With continuation feeding,
ongoing
cost is about, probably for a two-dog dog section, about $3,000 a year.
So $3,000, so actually it's not that much. So if you
No, not when you put the statistics on the ground.
A few hundred people putting a fiver in makes a really big difference to the work that you can do.
Well, one dog can secure an area of 32 square kilometres in one night shift.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it can do the same role as 60 searches covering the same time.
Good heavens.
So there is quite a benefit to having the dogs on section, which is why it's such a growth area in conservation.
Yeah, sure. What territories are you in? What countries are you in? Tell us how far your reach is as it exists right now, 6 years after starting.
We started in Kenya. We then moved to Tanzania to Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, we just now got into Mozambique, and we're going into Botswana later on in the year. The reason for this is because as we develop with anti-poaching, poaching develops as well, and it moves through countries. It obviously hits the weak spots. As we become find areas that are more secure, and we secure those areas, all they do is move down. And they move down with the migration routes, looking for weak areas of conservation.
Right. Okay. And the reason the game is moving, the reason that the elephants are moving, is they're looking for safe spots as they're being pushed further and further west, by the sounds of it, by the poaching gangs.
Yeah, definitely. When we talk about elephants, they really do think very similar to a human being, and they're very, very good at remembering routes. I mean, there's been evidence where they've actually gone through minefields and they've got to a certain point, just stopped dead and gone around it, because they can just, they've got a tremendous sense of smell. They can smell the explosives. They can smell the mines.
Good heavens.
They also know the reserves. They know where the conservancies are. So now the migration routes are actually changing, and they're moving through corridors through the conservancies, knowing that these are safe routes. When we talk about having fences up around a conservancy, it's not to keep the poachers out, it's to keep the animals in. Because obviously what we've formed through farming, intensive farming, is these have become bubbles with farmland all around. So we have to maintain that miniature ecosystem. We allow a small corridor through into the next conservancy or park, and the animals just keep moving through on the migration route safely.
Okay, a couple of maybe slightly tricky or controversial questions. poaching cannot exist in most of these countries with some sort of support, whether tacit or overt, from the people that live in those countries. Horns have to be removed, you know, taken across national borders, which involves immigration, customs, all that sort of stuff. How much support do you get from the governments and from the authorities within country for the work that you're doing?
In some countries, we get next to nothing. For instance, in Zimbabwe, we are licensed in certain parks to become guardians of those animals. So we have 156 rhino in one park. We're told that we have to look after them. We are told we're the guardians, but we get no funding whatsoever to actually do it. So everything that comes into that park financially, we have to generate and bring into that park.
Quite.
Other areas like Tanzania, you have the Tanapa Army, which is designed purely for that. You have Sand Parks, you have the KWS in Kenya, and they're designed to actually assist us. But it varies from country to country, certainly.
Can you talk a little bit about the KWS? Because 20 years ago, they seemed to be ineffectual, underfunded, although there was a great will from everybody from Leakey and all sorts of people that were trying to get them to really pull their, you know, really do the work they could do. Now it's a completely different thing. It seems to be much more effective. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
KWS is Kenyan Wildlife Service, by the way.
Yeah, there's been a reduction in poaching over the last 5 years by nearly 72% in the last 2 years alone.
In Kenya?
In Kenya alone.
And you put that largely down to the work that you're doing with dogs because of their extended reach.
Yes, obviously, dogs are not a silver bullet. They can't cure all ills. What they're saying is that with well-trained men on the ground and then the addition of drones, thermal imaging technology and dogs,
sure,
we've reduced poaching by 72%. But make no mistake, when we're talking about influencing governments in regards to poaching, it's people like yourselves that do that. It's only through pressure that they change, you know, that they change their thinking and sport.
They change their mindset, exactly. So 10 years from now, play it forward, what would the dream be if you had a strategic ambition from now to 10 years from now? What would you like to see happen? Where would animal saving animals be?
You're never going to stop poaching completely, but what we'd actually like is just simply for the reproduction rate to be greater than the poaching rate. And if we can achieve that, we'll be doing well. To give you an example, in Save Valley in Zimbabwe, the anti-poaching teams are that effective that they look for an annual reproduction rate of rhino of being at about 5%. They're now running at 14% reproduction. So other parks now are turning to Save and saying, well, how are you achieving this? But then if you look at the Kruger's running at 4%.
Good Lord.
With all the technology that they've got and everything that's going on.
And the resources they have available to them.
Exactly, and the resources, and they get millions a year. So clearly there's something wrong and there has to be adjustments in what we're doing.
That's fascinating. Do you have a sponsor a dog program or anything like that? Can people get online and find a way to sponsor a dog?
Yeah, we do. If you go onto the Animals Saving Animals website, you can sponsor one of our dogs. The difference between us and a larger organisation is that we visit all our dogs personally. I see all of my dogs. I'm very possessive over they are my dogs. I may give them to an organisation, but they're mine. You know, they've all got individual characters. You know, you have certain dogs, and they all have human traits. So when you look at these dogs and you look at the way they respond to people, you have the headstrong dog that no matter what you tell it to do, it's going to do its own thing. Then you have the dog that is just your perfect little infantry soldier, just does whatever you say. And then you have the dogs that pull it out of the bag. I've got a dog called Leo in Mozambique. He breaks every rule of tracking. You know, you teach this dog to track, and he should ground scent and follow this scent, and he doesn't. You put him on the track, he lifts his head and just goes off in completely the wrong direction. And I'm trying to correct these tracker handlers going, no, this is wrong, pull him off, and then he finds them. And you're like, oh my God, you know, how do you do this? But they all have these characters and traits which make them unique.
Fantastic. So the website's animalsavinganimals.org. Do have a look at that. It's your turn to ask. We've got 10 minutes for questions from you guys. If there's any questions you'd like to ask about poaching, elephants, rhinos, what the weather's like in Mozambique. And we'll start with the gentleman there, please.
Yes. Now and again, you do catch a poacher. What happens to them if they're caught?
Good question. What happens when a poacher gets caught?
Very good question. If I'm going to be honest with you, about 5 or 6 years ago, we would take the poacher into custody, give him to the local government, the local magistrate. He would bribe the local magistrate, and would be out again the following day. And it was very, very small fines. If they were caught, you're talking literally $150. Very small fines. through obviously legislation, through the pressure that the governments are now putting on the local African governments, these sentences are growing rather rapidly. To give you an example, we caught a chap in Zimbabwe last year, and he was actually a middleman, so he wasn't just a poacher. We actually managed to get the guy who was buying, and they opened the court. We caught him on the 30th of December. They opened the courts on the 31st, sentenced him on New Year's Eve to 35 years. So we are now, these sentences are being passed. And believe me, time in Africa is hard time. It really is. There's no parole. There's no license, getting out on license. It's not our... rangers by nature, including myself, we know all our animals. We know, because every rhino has a different clip in its ear, and we know where the rhinos are, because they all hold territories of about 35 square kilometres each. So as you can appreciate, when they, God forbid, they do poach one of our animals, we're not very happy about the situation. But it's not our job to do that. An officer, and obviously as an officer, commanding these men, I sometimes have to take a role, which is no, this isn't our job. Our job is to hand over to local magistrates. And we do that. But because now we are getting successful sentencing, it's a very clear message. And the good thing about the dogs are, there's an inherent fear of dogs in Africa.
Yep.
And even more so, because there is a certain belief in black magic, we make sure most of our dogs are black, which is even worse.
Oh, really? You actually...
Yeah, we do. We actually try. We actually
How
try.
Interesting.
If you look, a lot of them have the black in them.
Absolutely.
We deliberately do that. And word spreads very quickly, because a lot of the training and the exercises we do, we always do them on the boundary fences, so people can see what these dogs are doing, and they see these men getting taken over in full bite suits, and it's enough generally to actually move poaching to another conservancy. We haven't actually lost an animal. We've lost one animal in the last 18 months. We lost one 18 months ago in Kenya, and that was a successful horning, but they didn't get away. We actually caught them. But apart from that, we haven't lost an animal in 5 years on any of the conservancies. We've got dogs.
That makes a real difference. Now, question for the lady in the violet sweater, please.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just about.
I noticed that your activities are solely in Africa.
Yeah.
I also know that in India, in Kasaranga, they're using Malinois up there. Do you exchange any ideas? You know, the guys up in Kasaranga... and yourselves, do you sort of, exchange ideas about how you train your dogs or anything like that?
It's slightly hard to hear you, but can I summarise your question? The lady is aware that Animal Saving Animals seems to be largely African-based. She's aware that they're using Malinois as anti-poaching animals in India. Did I get that correctly? The question is there any exchange of information, training, protocols, anything between you and people in India?
Yeah, there is actually. We've been working with Kasaranga for advice and information for about the last 3 years. We often supply India with equipment, and we're actually in talks at the moment actually about putting some dogs actually out there. We're working with an organization called Tiger Awareness, and they're actually they've now got a dog unit, a four dog unit, and they're looking at expanding it out to six. So that is actually the next direction we're heading into for exactly the reason, because as you know, tiger bone is a huge resource.
Yep.
It's growing in value for certain purposes in certain countries. But what they're finding in now is, because it's becoming increasingly hard to take tiger down, they're now going for lion. So what we're finding in Africa is now is that there's been a sudden rise in poaching of lions, because if you take away certain limbs of a lion, it looks exactly the same as a tiger. So they're passing it off as tiger bone.
Oh,
so we've now got this.
What's happening?
Yeah, so we've now got this problem as well.
So there's an increasing threat against lion because of the scarcity and rarity of tigers.
Yeah, purely against
India.
That, yeah.
Good heavens. Hell. Another question, please. Yes, please, madam.
Hi, my name's Joanna. I just wanted to know what happens to the dogs when they retire from this role.
What happens to the dogs when they retire?
Basically, through a period of time, the dogs stay on the conservancy for their entire working life. Their working life is anything between 8 and 10 years. Once their working life is done, and we feel that they're not now, that they, you know, they should have retirement, you know. I mean, these dogs really do have it good. Honestly, they have a run. They're sort of 40, 50 foot. They're out all day with their handlers. They have a fantastic life. But as you said, there's this time where certain illnesses, diseases cut in, and, you know, hip dysplasia, and they just have to rest. When that happens, they're always taken on by the conservancy. I can tell you now, we've got one dog that's actually the security manager's pet, and he just retires. If not, they get taken on by the handlers and they stay with the handlers. They never, because even though they finish their operational work in life, there's obviously going to be, as you would expect, every 10 years a rotation in dogs. It slowly rotates. So what we do is you have a green handler that's coming up through the ranks and he's never touched an animal before. The operational dogs are out on unit all day. So what we use is we use the older dogs to teach the newer handlers. I mean, as we said, the older dogs just look at the newer handlers and they go, this is going to be great fun. You know, we can drag you around wherever we want. But it's a good way of teaching. It's a good way of prolonging the working life of a dog and giving them a more enjoyable life. But no dogs get put down. They always stay on the conservancies afterwards. They're a valued member of team. You know, these dogs will stay with their handlers and normally with a 4 or 5 man scout patrol their entire working lives. You know, a lot of the time, the ranger actually feel a lot happier when the dogs are there because these dogs are like early warning systems. You know, when you've got poachers that are waiting in ambush or poachers that we're going after, dogs change their behaviour when they get close. So you'll have a tracker dog, for instance. He'll have his nose down and he'll be going on the ground, powering along, tail will be down. As soon as he gets within 200-300 metres of that quarry, his nose will raise up and he'll start air scenting because then it's a lot higher pop density of scent. His tail will go up, he'll start pulling, and that's when the tracker handler can just get down and go 200 metres in front, poaching team. So this is why we use them like we do, because they're an invaluable asset to the teams.
Good question. Another question? Yes, please, sir.
Okay. Where is most of this ivy and rhino horn going to? What countries?
Where is most of the ivory and rhino horn going to?
Oh, that's a very controversial question.
Often to Southeast Asia or East Asia?
China.
Let's Hong call Kong. It what it is.
Ivory, Hong Kong. Like I said, the figures that I raised from regarding to ivory, $3,000 to $5,000 for a 15 kilos or tusk of ivory. Time it gets to Hong Kong, $320,000. Simple as that. And as I said, rhino horn is actually just it's growing in value faster than we can actually, you know, that we can cope with it because it's tripled in 6 years. And what we're finding now is that poachers are now actually going for an extinction event. They actually want this, so they're stockpiling it. Because as soon as it's an extinction event, CITES gets lifted.
Yeah.
So then you've got a horn with a huge demand at huge prices. So this is what they're going for now, which is why we're having to become anti-poaching teams now are now, they're soldiers, effectively. They're having to be taught as soldiers.
That's also where the big cat bones, where the tiger bones and China bone, because, of course, in traditional medicine, it still is seen as a very powerful powerful resource. Do we have another question? Any more questions? You're by means, Roddy. Yes, of course you're allowed to ask a question.
I'm very keen to know. I've watched a police dog once going absolutely nuts at somebody, but completely under control. And then I've read on your beautiful slideshow that sometimes they go, your dogs go absolutely silent when they know to be quiet. How do you train a dog to use its voice or not?
We actually teach the dogs to speak, because once you've taught a dog to speak, you can then teach it to be silent. You can go quiet, speak, quiet, speak. So when they're in
is
ambush...
Is that the hand gesture you use?
That's one of them, yeah. Quiet! if we're in an ambush situation, the dogs will just lay down silently. And what happens is, when the poachers are approaching, the dogs will just lift themselves up and they'll point, and that's enough. And then they go down for an ambush situation. If we need them to speak, i.e. a guard situation, so when we say guard, what we can effectively do with the dogs is we can put the dog into a standoff mode. So we have a poacher, put him in a stress position, put him on the ground, guard. The dog will just stand there and guard. Providing that poacher doesn't move, that dog will just keep him, ooh, 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 and he won't move. If he moves any limb, the dog will re-attack. What I will say is I've had this happen before with a poacher. We had a dog called Tarzan, and he was one of our veterans, so he's been in the job 6-7 years. And we have another command called escort, which is where the dog walks directly behind the poacher or the person we've apprehended, and providing the person just walks normally and moves in direction in command, the dog doesn't re-attack. And this dog was walking behind the poacher doing this, making him move, trying to nose him, just nudging him, getting him to do anything, just pushing him along, just react in some way so I can then bite you. And we're like, Tarzan, back off, Tarzan. He's sort of going backwards, but he's doing it under pure...
Superb. I've got two quick questions that I should have asked earlier on. One is, Do the dogs enjoy the work? I know other from other canine units that I am aware of, anti-drugs, anti-explosives, all that sort of stuff, that the dogs actually really enjoy. They know it's not play, they know it's work, but they actually enjoy the work. Is it the same with the anti-poaching dogs?
Yeah. Everything we do in regards to training is done through play. So it's a high... What we do is any part of the training we do, there's always a high resource reward at the end of it. Nothing we do is trained through aggression. So when you see, you know, certain trainers, certain people, and they think the way to bring aggression out of a dog is to become aggressive themselves.
Yep.
It doesn't work. What you have to do, the dog, it is always primarily a game to the dog. So if we do a track out in the field, there's always a ball weighing at the end of it. When he finds the weapon part or ammunition, we replace it with a ball, and then the dog gets the ball. What I will say about the apprehension is he loves it. They absolutely love it, because we teach apprehension training through a tug toy. We start off with a tug toy, and it's just a pull toy that we move back and forth. So when you've got some guy with a sleeve on, it's just an extension of that, and the dog loves it. You know, he absolutely loves it.
Superb. And the last question for me is this, which is the obvious one. I should have asked ages ago. Where do you get your dogs from? Are they bred, reared here in the UK, and you take them out to country, or are they bred in country?
No, the first litter we had, 11 dogs were actually bred out in Kenya. But what we found, to be honest with you, we just couldn't find the bloodlines, the breeding lines.
Right.
Again, when you're selecting a puppy, bloodlines, breeding lines are everything. If you want a good success rate, I'm the first to say that you can get a crossbreed or a rehome, and it can make a fantastic tracker dog, fantastic search dog. It does happen. But we're talking about large amounts of money being invested into these dogs, so ideally we need a high success rate. We've never had a dog fail through training. The reason we moved the dogs from Kenya from the UK was we could just get those selected breeding bloodlines that we needed to actually carry on training.
Fantastic. Can I say thank you for coming? Because I know that you've come back from very important work in Mozambique to be here today. And thank you for taking the time. And well done on the work. Can I say to all of you, as you do exit, Daryl hasn't got a book to sell, so there's no book for him to sign. But we might put him over there for 5 minutes or so in the Stanford signing tent if you're too shy to ask a question of him, or if you want to ask further information from him. Is that all right with
you?
Yeah,
of course it is.
And if you are able, please do give generously in the collecting tins as you leave, because as you can see, each pound that gets donated to this charity goes straight on the ground and makes a difference and helps preserve the very animals that we go to these countries to see. Would you please give huge thanks to you, first of all? Thank you very much indeed. All put your right arms up in the air. All put your right arms up in the air. Bend them at the elbow. Give yourselves a bloody good pat on the back. And now give a huge round of applause, please, to Daryl Pleasance and Animals Saving Animals.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.